certainly we're seeing a trend of suspects ramming patrol cars and trying to run down officers. That seems new to us.
The Anchorage Police Department announces a new policy aimed at reducing officer-involved shootings. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, making a point at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting.
It's green with rainbow colors, and it has a 75-foot banner of a sperm whale.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The U.S. Senate has started debating a plan to overhaul the nation's immigration system. If successful, it will be the first time Congress revamps immigration laws in a quarter century. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, passage is more likely in the Senate than the House. And in the Senate, both Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski could be at the center of the debate.
Majority Leader Harry Reid says he wants the Senate to pass its bill by the 4th of July recess. He promises an open amendment process, complete with votes on all sorts of tweaks to the bill. And rest assured, many of those amendments will be laced with politics. Texas Senator John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the chamber, introduced an amendment that infuriates some Republicans and Democrats who wrote the bill. It would effectively require 100% border enforcement before anyone can gain legal status.
Are you open to rewriting or redrafting your amendment to make it more palatable to Democrats?
If by that you mean ineffective, no.
Reid called Cornyn's amendment poisonous, and that's not exactly a collegial way to start the conversation. Still, with two procedural votes, the Senate voted overwhelmingly to begin debate. The bill itself was crafted by a group of eight senators, four Democrats, four Republicans. President Barack Obama strongly supports the plan. In his weekly address, he said Congress has addressed bits and pieces of the issue over the past few years, but it has the chance to pass something much larger.
It's a compromise. Nobody will get everything they want. Not Democrats, not Republicans, not me. But it is a bill that's largely consistent with the principles I've repeatedly laid out for common sense immigration reform.
Those include a path to citizenship that's at least 12 years long for the millions of illegal immigrants in the country, tougher penalties for employers who knowingly hire unauthorized workers, and heightened protections at the borders. The president says he wants Congress to deliver him a bill to sign by the end of the summer.
We know the opponents of reform are going to do everything they can to prevent that. They'll try to stoke fear and create division. They'll try to play politics with an issue that the vast majority of Americans want addressed. And if they succeed, we will lose this chance to finally fix an immigration system that is badly broken.
Both Alaska senators voted to move the bill forward. At the very least, six Republicans will need to vote for the bill for it to pass. Democrats will be hoping Senator Murkowski will vote with them. She voted to pass an overhaul in 2006. And Senator Begich's moves will be closely watched, too. He's one of six senators up for re-election in 2014 in Republican states. Both Murkowski and Begich say a major concern is making sure fish processors have the workforce they need. Murkowski says people in the state are divided over J-1 visas, the work permits for foreign workers who fill the processing plants.
Well, you've got folks, for instance, in Kodiak that look at this, and they want these local jobs here for their folks. And so for them, some of the seasonal workers coming in are a little bit more of a concern.
The J-1 visa program expired last November, and Begich says fish processors are having trouble filling job openings this season. Begich says he's hopeful the new plan will lump those workers in with the so-called W-visa workers. W-visas will cover all sorts of low-skilled employees, and they are a product of a joint effort between the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO.
We think it will work, but we want to be clear that there's no doubt that it can be utilized.
He says if the Senate does not interpret W-visas to include J-1s, he'll try and amend the bill. There's some optimism in the Capitol the Senate could pass a sweeping piece of legislation. Speaker of the House John Boehner said the president could have something to sign by the end of the year. That's later than the president is asking for. And maybe that's a sign smooth sailing should not be expected. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Anchorage police announced a new policy today aimed at preventing officers from shooting at moving vehicles, a practice that has increased over the past few years. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
There have been 10 officer-involved shootings involving moving vehicles over the past decade. That concerns Anchorage Police Department Chief Mark Mew. That's why he says the department has added a new section to its use of force policy. It goes like this.
Unless use of deadly force is otherwise justified, an officer shall not shoot at a moving vehicle if the vehicle being used is being used as the only weapon.
He says one situation that would justify shooting at a moving vehicle is if an officer in the line of duty found himself in the middle of a drive-by shooting. But otherwise, the policy forbids shooting at vehicles. The policy is part of a larger plan, Mew says, to prevent officer-involved shootings, which have drawn unwanted attention to the force that serves Alaska's largest city. There were 3 officer-involved shootings with moving vehicles in 2013 and 1 in 2012. Mew says once the trend was identified, leadership researched how other law enforcement agencies around the country have reduced such shootings.
Certainly we're seeing a trend of suspects ramming patrol cars and trying to run down officers. That seems new to us. Our officers have been responding in the way that they felt best, but we thought it would be better for everybody, for the public generally, and for the officers if we retooled a bit and tried to make sure we weren't in those circumstances anymore and that we had better tools to deal with them.
Mew says researchers can't pinpoint exactly why there's been an increase in such incidents. Earlier this year, the APD met with state troopers and the FBI to discuss how to reduce officer-involved shootings. Mew acknowledged that the new policy came out of those meetings. He says officers have been informed of the policy, and by and large, they were on board. He says the overall use of force policy is under review, and more changes will likely be announced in the fall. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Museum takes on a unique project that's getting scientists and artists out in the field.
We're organizing it as an art exhibition, but I don't think you can separate art and science in this case.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Carved into the Bering Sea shelf are some of the ocean's largest underwater canyons. The bigger ones run more than a mile deep, and in spots, they're dense with corals and sponges. They're also home to some commercial fisheries, and factory trawlers often catch pollock there. Now fisheries regulators have charted a path for managing this unique habitat, which allows for future conservation measures. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
North Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings can be dry affairs. They happen in hotels or conference halls. They involve lots of acronyms and hours upon hours of testimony. Lawyers and scientists will sometimes outnumber fishermen. So it's a little odd to see activists holding up a hand-painted banner the length of a swimming pool at one of these things, and even weirder to have a large blimp make an appearance for a meeting.
It's green with rainbow colors, and it has a 75-foot banner of a sperm whale and huge lettering that says, "Protect my home."
That's Jackie Dragon, an oceans campaigner with Greenpeace. The airship is part of a massive conservation campaign over what her group calls the Grand Canyons of the Bering Sea. They're worried trawl nets are scraping away at the canyon's sea life. This week, they argued their case before the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. In the end, what they got was a commitment for more research on the canyons. The council also agreed to start examining ways to reduce the impact the trawl and longline fleets have on the coral population. Dragon calls that a win for environmental groups.
The fact that they're doing the short-term protection immediately and getting that started out of the gate, together with this longer-range plan, is something that we have to commend.
The council was unanimous in its agreement for a research initiative, and they discussed the possibility of eventually implementing a fishery ecosystem plan, a holistic approach to management that can include conservation measures like marine reserves. But they didn't call for any immediate closures in the region, like some advocates for the canyons wanted. Members of the fishing industry warned that shutting down fishing would be premature without a specific goal for that action. Stephanie Madsen directs the At Sea Processors Association, a factory trawler group.
First, it's corals. Then the blimp of Greenpeace has a whale on it. Then World Wildlife talks about marine mammals and birds. People talk about Chinook bycatch, although we've already taken management measures for that, and our footprint's already been diminished in the Pribilof Canyon with that activity. So I get confused about what the objectives are.
Madsen adds that she's somewhat skeptical of Greenpeace's motives, because in the past, they've aggressively campaigned for an end to factory trawling altogether. She's noticed a change in tactics. Instead of protesters chaining themselves to ships, they've got lobbyists working the regulatory process. But ultimately, she thinks the end purpose is similar. Jackie Dragon says that, yes, Greenpeace still opposes factory trawling. But instead of wholesale bans, they're taking a more strategic approach.
I think it's important to be reasonable. I don't think that they are in a position tomorrow to create closures for representative portions of the habitat in the Bering Sea.
The North Pacific Council will be following up with another look at the impact fishing has on corals in the area at the end of the year. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
An ambitious expedition to study ocean trash launched from Seward on Friday. The Gyre Project is a collaboration between the Anchorage Museum and the Alaska Sea Life Center, among other organizations, to document the impact of marine debris along Alaska's shoreline and across the globe. APRN's Sarah Bernard reports.
Alaskans have been thinking about marine debris lately, thanks to all the trash that's washing up on the state's coastline after the 2011 tsunami in Japan. This week, Julie Decker with the Anchorage Museum will get a firsthand look at that trash. It's not the kind of thing she usually does for her job as the museum's chief curator.
I think this has been fascinating. I think it's been an education for me, for the artists, for the scientists, to talk to the artists.
The project began this week when a team of 16 marine biologists, educators, and artists boarded a research vessel to collect data and materials along the Kenai Peninsula. The idea for the project came from Howard Farron, director of conservation at the Alaska Sea Life Center. He says trash, and especially plastic, has been a huge issue in our oceans for years now.
It's a very recent phenomenon, and yet we already have some projections are maybe 100 million tons of plastics in the oceans. There's no easy way to define that. But what we can tell you is that there are impacts, significant and growing.
That's why Farron approached the Anchorage Museum about 3.5 years ago to propose a collaboration that would link science with art. Although the project now involves dozens of people and has many moving parts, the museum's Julie Decker says the integration of all the elements will be pretty seamless.
We're organizing it as an art exhibition, but I don't think you can separate art and science in this case. The artists serve as researchers into the issue. They're passionate investigators of how this affects our planet, and most of the artists came to their work because they live along the ocean, see it, lived it, started to collect it, and it made its way into their artwork.
Decker says the exhibit will feature a wide range of artwork, both from artists on the expedition this week and from others around the world.
There's a woman who collects beach trash in California and then repackages them as souvenirs. Artists from Finland collecting trash on their beaches and creating false aquariums. Somebody creating snow globes with beach trash along the Yukon River.
The exhibit will also include the scientific results of this week's expedition, as well as a series of videos by National Geographic filmmakers. When it all comes together, Decker says, what she really hopes the project will spark is discussion.
We're not advocates for a point of view. What we're interested in is talking about our oceans, talking about plastic, talking about human consumption and human action. And I think it's a fascinating story and one that really can impact everyone. And I think everybody can understand how it's tangible to us.
Decker herself is joining the expedition for one day this week to participate in a beach cleanup at Hallow Bay in Katmai National Park. The exhibit will run at the Anchorage Museum from February through August 2014. After that, it'll be repackaged by the Smithsonian Institution to tour the Lower 48. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Bernard.
A group of University of Alaska Fairbanks professors will develop an engineering school in Mongolia over the next few years. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, UAF signed a contract this spring with the American University of Mongolia in that country's capital, where the new school will be based.
A team of seven professors from UAF are developing curriculum and designing classroom space for an engineering school at a newly formed American University of Mongolia. Rajiv Ganguly is heading up the project. He's the chairman of the Mining and Geological Engineering Program at UAF.
For me and my team, it is very exciting. It is wild to think that you're going to create a college of engineering from scratch. So, you know, the stuff that we like about the education system here and the stuff we hate, you know, hey, we get to remedy it, you know. And so what we want to do is we will review engineering education in some of the top universities, and we have our own ideas, and we'll take a look at all of those things and steal from the best.
Ganguly says Mongolia and Alaska are natural partners when it comes to mining in the far north.
I think that our cold climate engineering expertise, our mining engineering expertise, is very relevant to Mongolia, and they could benefit from it. And so we have academic agreements with Mongolia University of Science and Technology and with Erdenet Mining Corporation.
There's no federal funding going toward the effort. Ganguly doesn't have a solid dollar amount on what development of the school might cost, but he expects it will be in the tens of millions of dollars. He says nearly all of that money will come from private sector mining companies in Mongolia.
Mining has been booming in Mongolia for a few years. And their economy has taken off. They're one of the fastest growing economies in the world at about 17%. And so when you grow that fast, you need lots of good employees, especially in engineering, given the investment in infrastructure and mines, et cetera.
Officials with American University of Mongolia hope to admit the first engineering students within 2 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
A Sitka-based barge line hopes to return to serving Southeast by the end of the year. It depends on a shipping industry shuffle, where a much larger company is trying to absorb its chief competitor. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Samson Tug and Barge used to do a lot of business with loggers and mills around Southeast Alaska. But as the timber industry shrunk, the line's service area moved farther west. The Sitka-based company now carries cargo to and from Seattle, Prince William Sound, the Kenai Peninsula, Kodiak, King Cove, and Dutch Harbor. The list could expand later this year.
We started in Southeast. We still have our headquarters in Southeast, so why not be in Southeast? It just makes sense.
Corey Baggin is vice president of Samson Tug and Barge.
We've looked at entering the Southeast market over the years, but with two carriers in the region, there really hasn't been room for a third.
That number could shrink later this year. Linden Incorporated, which owns Alaska Marine Lines, is in the process of buying Northland Services Incorporated. The two lines handle the lion's share of cargo shipments to Southeast communities. Samson does some barging to and from Sitka. Baggin says the purchase allows her company to compete in other communities.
Our plans right now are to service Ketchikan, Juneau, Wrangell, Petersburg, all of Prince of Wales Island, and Metlakatla.
Northland's barge line will continue to exist as a Linden subsidiary, but operations will be combined in Southeast towns that both serve. The purchase has to clear a number of hurdles. Among the concerns, the combination could effectively create a monopoly. Linden CEO John Burdick says that's why his corporation is encouraging Samson's Southeast expansion.
There is a regulatory review process, and the state of Alaska wants to ensure that where there's competitive overlap between Linden and Northland, that there's alternative services available.
Burdick says buying Northland expands Linden's service area to western Alaska as well as Hawaii. But he says Linden's Alaska Marine Line subsidiary will not reduce Southeast port calls.
At a minimum, they'll receive equal frequency of service.
In terms of equaling what AML's doing now or what AML plus Northland's doing now?
AML plus Northland.
Burdick expects most Northland employees will either keep their jobs or find new ones with Alaska Marine Lines or Samson Tug and Barge. Baggins says her company will be hiring.
Eventually, we'll probably double our size. Probably have somewhere between 120 and 160 employees.
And will those folks be based in Alaska or a lot of them be out of Seattle?
No, most of them will be based in Alaska. We're going to pick up a few more people and we're going to have to increase our warehouse size. We're going to have to increase the amount of space we're taking up for our yard. You know, we'll have to have more trucks and that kind of thing down here in Seattle. But most of those employees will be in Alaska.
Baggin understands her company will compete against a much larger operation. She says Samson will do that by providing personalized customer service.
We're not the big box carrier. We're not going to be the one that says, you better do it at this time, this way. We don't care how you want to do it. We're going to say, hey, what do you need? And we're going to do the best we can to come in and really work for the customers.
Linden and Samson expect the sale to be completed by the end of this year, and both say they'll be ready for a quick transition. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A young brown bear cub was recently found near Platinum and turned into the Fish and Game Office in Bethel. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has the story.
The bear was a tiny male, 9 pounds in all. It was reportedly being chased by some dogs, so Jay Bitney picked him up to try to keep him safe. Bitney had been in the area for work, crushing gravel. On June the 3rd, he contacted the Alaska State Troopers, who then sent out a wildlife enforcement officer to the village. Unfortunately, it was soon learned that the bear had to be euthanized. Bear cubs are not desired by most zoos, according to Philip Perry, area management biologist for the state. He found that out after checking with their headquarters in Juneau that works with zoos and other animal facilities for possible placements of wild animals.
At that point, we're told, you know, there's not any zoos in the U.S. that are requesting a single brown bear cub that was a male.
Perry says that's in part because it takes a lot of work and funding to keep a brown bear in captivity, which can live up to 25 years old.
A little cub's pretty cute, but they're going to rapidly grow up, and they need a pretty secure cage, and they need a way to feed them. It's a big commitment.
Even though this cub was just 9 pounds, he was born in the wintertime in a den where he stayed with his mother until spring. It's unknown what happened to his mother as she wasn't seen in this case. Perry says in all cases, it's best for people to play it safe if they ever do come across bear cubs or even baby moose this time of year and ask the important question.
Uh-oh, where's mom?
Perry says this time of year, the mom is usually nearby.
Mom's going to be very defensive. So most people's instinct at that point is, you know, to back away. You don't want to run away, but you want to slowly and deliberately leave the area.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The U.S. Forest Service believes fish populations in Redout Lake near Sitka survived last month's devastating landslide unharmed. The massive avalanche piled up debris more than 20 feet thick across the lake's inlet stream, completely destroying a nearby recreational cabin whose occupants escaped in the nick of time. A watershed team recently surveyed the area and concluded that the lake's sockeye run was likely unaffected and may even be improved. They're expecting this year's subsistence fishery, the most popular in the Sitka area, to take place normally. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The sockeye start to return to Redout Lake around July 4th. Subsistence dip netters get their shot at the silvery torpedoes in the lake's outlet stream. About a month later, the sockeye are entering Redout's inlet stream, Redout Creek, which is now under 20 feet of mud, rock, and timber.
It's
not really a waterfall. It's a low enough gradient that they should be able to get up that. I mean, it's really not a lot different than the outlet falls to the lake to go into salt water.
Perry Edwards is an ecosystem biologist for the Sitka Ranger District.
So there's a short area where they'll have to really motor to get up through there, but the fisheries biologist was confident that sockeye should easily be able to ascend that and get up into that upper lake area and then the stream. And some of them may actually spawn in that new lake that's been created up there.
New lake? Mother Nature did more than scare the living daylights out of us when she chased Kevin Knox, Maggie Gallen, and their dog Luna down the lakeshore on May 12th. She also built a dam. During interviews following the episode, Knox reported that the stream was starting to carve a new channel through the debris field, but the stream was also slowly backing up. Perry Edwards says there's now a 55-acre lake formed between the walls of the gorge. In some places, it's 35 feet deep. Over 5 miles of the creek upstream of the lake remain unaffected. Edwards has no idea if the new lake is permanent.
Only time is going to tell. There was a lot of material that came down that slide, a lot of old-growth trees that were 3-foot diameter and or full lengths of trees that are crisscrossing in there like pixie sticks. So it's going to really take some energy between that and some boulders that, my understanding, were the size of Volkswagens came down through there. That it may be there for the long haul. Or large flows may come through and carve itself down through that. We're really not going to know until time goes by.
The good news for fishermen is that the slide occurred at about the time sockeye salmon fry leave the stream gravels and move into the lake. The warming temperatures and snowmelt, which likely triggered the slide, also contributed to transporting salmon. The fry don't swim downstream, they drift, and Edwards and his team think any fry that weren't already in the lake probably made it safely over the new dam. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well-rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.